It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. I was delighted to read this earlier this morning. Sixto Rodriguez is a name you may be familiar with by now. He's the star of Searching for Sugar Man, that extraordinary movie about him, which won an Oscar. He will be, this is an extraordinary story in and of itself. He became famous as a musician in South Africa, and apparently he didn't find out about it until years after the fact. So it was just made to win an Oscar, made to win an Academy Award. He will receive a Doctor of Humane Letters on May 9th from Wayne State University. Got to see that movie. It is the last day of the month. The day Current State reviews the top news stories from the previous 30 days and what they mean moving forward. And here to help us do that today, Walt Sorg, columnist for City Pulse. Kyle Malin is back from MERS, the Michigan Information and Research Service. And Rick Pluta represents the Michigan Public Radio Network. Good morning to all of you.
Morning.
Good morning.
Let's start out
representing.
Representing. Let's start out by discussing a guy who appears he will throw his hat in the ring for the U.S. Senate. From Michigan, this is Democratic Congressman Gary Peters. He is set to make an announcement tomorrow. Many expect it will be about his candidacy. Here is Congressman Gary Peters about a month ago here on Current State.
Certainly with Carl's retirement, I've been approached by many, many people, lots and lots of phone calls to consider this, and I've told folks I will definitely give it serious consideration because it's very important. The U.S. Senate seat is very important for Michigan. But it is one in which, first and foremost, it is about family, and that's something that we'll have to spend a little time talking about.
Kyle Malin, assess Gary Peters as a candidate and his chances of becoming our next senator.
Well, I would say his chances are very strong, and his chances of becoming the next U.S. Senator of Michigan are over 50-50, I would say. The Democratic field has pretty much cleared the way over these last several weeks for Gary Peters for this nomination. The only other Democrat who is even considering this, Debbie Dingell, the Democratic National Committee woman, said a couple weeks ago that she was not going to run, and that pretty much threw all the support behind Gary Peters. Earlier this week or earlier this month, we had every single member of the Democratic caucus on the Senate side and all but a handful on the House side support Gary Peters, just to kind of punctuate and emphasize his coronation, I guess, as the Democratic nominee. And
well, to announce in advance that, you know, that the dance has begun, you know, sort of put the needle down on the record player, saying, you know, this is the Senate race and he's the candidate.
What will people make of Peters who don't know about him, though? Walt Sorg, any thoughts on that?
I think he's going to try to portray that Levin image of being more studious, of not being flashy, because he's not flashy. He's moderately boring, but he's got to play to that. I think he's going to have the advantage. My guess is Mike Rogers will not run for the Republicans. I don't think he's not a gambler when it comes to his political future, and he very likely is going to end up with an opponent who's from the right side of the Republican Party. And I think Peters is just going to come across as that solid centrist, progressive thinking Democrat, and I think he'll be in good shape.
Well, we can come back to the Republican field in a few minutes, because that's really kind of the fascinating story here, because, you know, that's where all the potential for conflict is. I would disagree that Gary Peters is a boring speaker. I was at the Democratic convention, and he delivered a more than passable stem winder when he was there. But I think you're right that what he's going to want to do is, you know, it's hard to explain to outsiders what an iconic politician Carl Levin is in Michigan. And I think one of the questions in the campaign that Democrats are considering is, how can they create a mantle to be passed? That you know, this is really about continuing.
It really worked from
legacy.
Phil Hart to Carl Levin. It passed on, and that is the challenge, to make it go from Levin to Peters.
The senior senator mystique.
And at the same time, you know, one of the many challenges that Republicans are going to, you know, face in this is basically going and saying Gary Peters is no Carl Levin.
And that he's liberal, too. I mean, you got to keep that in mind. I mean, they're already trying
to lay
the grain.
When he was in the state Senate, he was the most liberal member of the state Senate, and that history is going to be resurrected.
I had to ask about the awareness of Peters outstate, simply because so much has been made in terms of how few Democrats know about Mark Schauer and Bart Stupak. That's been an issue on the gubernatorial side of the ledger, but nobody seems to be concerned about awareness of Gary Peters.
Well, Gary Peters did run though in 2002 statewide in a very competitive race.
Attorney General.
Yeah. Well, it was still Attorney General, but you know he had that statewide presence, and I think as Walt was just about ready to say, Oakland County is a significant part of the state, and now that he's had to campaign in Detroit like he did last year to keep his seat in the Senate, folks know who Gary Peters is, and I think
that
he doesn't have a hurdle.
That district runs through a hefty swath of the most populated part of Michigan. That's one of the appeals of Gary Peters as a candidate. Another is, on paper, here's a guy who's served in the military. He's an officer in the Naval Reserve. He's been to the Middle East. That his pre-political background is in finance, and so you know he can argue that he's got some knowledge of matters financial, that he is a practical person. There is that history of Peters in some respects kind of underperforming when he was on the Granholm ticket to run for Attorney General after not making it in the primary to be the gubernatorial candidate. And that's sort of the question mark, which is Gary Peters someone who plays well in Southeast Michigan and then sort of collapses on a statewide stage, or is he someone who's now, you know, really ready for prime time?
I would say it was the party that collapsed on him when he ran for Attorney General. They just basically abandoned him.
Any other thoughts on the Republican side here? Walt weighed in, doesn't think Mike Rogers is going to run.
I would love to see Mike Rogers run because it would give us a great U.S. Senate race to cover, I would say. I mean, it would give us something absolutely competitive, but I think Walt's got a great point there in that he has not been a real risk taker when it comes to his political future. When he has run competitive races, though, I mean, 2000 with Diane Byron.
That was his first congressional race and his last competitive race, and then
he won, though.
Then Republican, yes.
100 votes.
Yeah, wins a win,
And then the Republican legislature made sure that he always had super safe districts to run in.
Mitt Romney carried his current district by about 4 points.
It's been a long time since he's faced that kind of a race. He's got a very powerful, responsible position that he will be able to keep, that it's not chair of the House Intelligence Committee, is not subject to the term limits on congressional committee chairs, and he is a well-known and influential commodity in Washington. Does he want to risk that? A lot of people are talking about Justin Amash, a libertarian Tea Partier from West Michigan. But in Terry Lynn Land, a lot of people are also talking about. We've got some of the same issues with Gary Peters that we referred to before that. The question is, can Republicans avoid a big, divisive, expensive primary? And if Mike Rogers does not get into the race, a lot of Republicans think not.
Before we get too wrapped up in 2014, let's continue looking back on April here. About 10 days ago, word got out of the so-called Skunk Works panel working on getting more from technology in our schools and working at what they refer to as value schools. Here is Richard McClellan, who told me that he is responsible for naming this group.
And we'd like to say thank you for that.
Right. Here is Richard McClellan commenting on this just after it broke.
I'm interested in whether or not we've got some ideas in Michigan to use technology to improve the quality of education and drive down the cost. That's the purpose. That's the name. And it was deliberately called Skunk Works because we were not using the education establishment on the grounds that they have a hard time looking at new ideas and we're seeing it exactly that. They're attacking it before they've ever seen it.
Walt Sorg, how has the dust settled on this development? What does this mean?
Well, the fact that it was the Detroit News that outed this, I think, probably really hurt them, because the Detroit News isn't exactly known as your left-wing newspaper.
Well, don't confuse the editorial pages of the Detroit News with the news pages of the editorial of the Detroit News.
I'm not confused, but a lot of other people would be.
Chad Livengood broke this for the news.
But that didn't help them in the least. The fact that they've left out the entire education establishment, I take issue with my friend Richard on that, simply impressive. You know, places like Dansville, where they're doing all sorts of pilot programs incorporating the iPad into the classroom, those sorts of things are going on. And leaving the education establishment out and bringing in financial interests that stand to gain with further privatization of the schools, whether it's through the internet or through charter schools or whatever, just makes the whole thing suspect. I think they've
this is basically taking the teacher out of the classroom and putting a computer or something else in front of these kids and trying to drive down the cost of educating kids from about $7,000 per pupil to $5,000 per pupil. You can't have that discussion with the traditional education lobbyists in the room because they're all trying to protect their own.
You look at leaving the educational establishment, you know, that Dick McClellan said he did not want the education establishment in the room because the educational establishment, you know, can kill it. And I think that they proved once again that that was absolutely the case.
How nefarious was this, though?
I think these things happen all the time, quite frankly. I mean, the governor or an administration or legislators have work groups and little, you know, hashing out sessions where they get together and toss around ideas all the time. I think the difference here is that this one, A, got outed, and B, it's kind of like this idea of education that folks have a real discomfort level to, and it could be easily politicized as saying this is a backdoor attempt to get vouchers back into the public school system, and what in the heck is the governor doing?
Well, this just wasn't a group of people who were sitting around in the dorm room late at night coming up with big ideas. These were people who were very, very close to Governor Snyder who were, you know, coming up with this plan, which is why it gave some people, not everyone,
heartburn?
Yeah, the willies.
Well, you also add into it the funding appeal from the private school in Ann Arbor where the governor sends his kids who are saying that we can't educate our kids for $20,000 a year. We need more money. The timing of that was just horrendous for them.
What kind of future does it have? Apparently, the group is still going to meet. McClellan's dropped out. But what kind of future does it have with Mike Flanagan on board?
That's a shroud.
Yeah, okay.
This has gone away. Its mission has been diluted to the point of irrelevance. We're looking at technology in classrooms. Well, who isn't?
I don't think you're going to see it go away that quickly because there are some very
the controversy may not.
There's some very potent forces in the Republican Party in the state and nationally, who even go to the point of saying we shouldn't have a public school system. When you get to the libertarians like Neil Bortz at the national level, I think you'll find the DeVos's a part of that as well, even if they don't say it publicly. And these are very powerful people within the Republican Party. This is one of those issues. I wouldn't be surprised to see some action in the lame duck next year.
Well, school reform never goes away.
That's right.
The
issue I don't think goes away. I think Skunk Works goes away.
Let's turn to roads and road funding. Governor Snyder wants just over $1 billion for that, paid for by higher gas taxes and a bump in registration fees. He apparently needs the votes
of Democrats. Well, he just wants the money. That's just one idea.
Well, when you get paid $1 a year, I mean, you want the money, right?
No, he's collecting his salary.
He's collecting his salary now.
He is, okay. He apparently needs the votes of Democrats who may be hesitating over worries the GOP could repeal Michigan's prevailing wage law. House Minority Leader Tim Grimmel last week likened the situation to terrorism, which became a story in itself. Is the my question, is the governor's plan alive?
Oh, no, it's not. It hasn't been alive for some time. But I think the issue of raising the gas tax somehow and reconfiguring how that gas tax is collected is very much alive, as is tinkering around with driver registration fees. A 60% increase in driver registration fee isn't going to fly, but 20%, could that fly? Could reconfiguring how people pay their driver registration fees, streamlining it somehow to raise some more money? I think that's very much alive.
One of the questions that Democrats have to consider is what do they want in exchange for giving away votes on a tax hike?
Yes.
Is a promise not to repeal prevailing wage sufficient? Is it more money for schools? Is, you know, how far down that road do you have to do before you're going to put your members up to take what could be some politically perilous votes? I mean, we should talk a little bit about that kerfuffle last week. What happened was Tim Grimmel was the House Democratic leader was talking about the negotiations. Republicans had made noises that if Democrats would not put up the votes, maybe they would go for a more comprehensive solution, which was code for, you know, maybe looking at things like prevailing wage. And Tim Grimmel used the phrase, "We will not bargain with terrorists," which is is it's something that a lot of people say in a lot of different contexts. I have young children, and my daughter will sometimes say, "I am not going to clean my room until you promise me Jell-O for dessert." I say, "I will not bargain with terrorists."
On the heels of the Boston thing, though, it came at a bad time.
So after that, and his press secretary, even had to admit that even though that it was a toss-out, but boy, was it a poor choice of words, considering, the moment. It wasn't quite an apology, but, it was still out there. But then, later on that afternoon, after being accused of insensitivity, Democrats put out another press release basically going, well, you want to talk about insensitivity, talk about the Republicans who, serve on the House Insurance Committee, who walked out in the middle of the hearing on the no-fault reform, and all the people there with the, who were in wheelchairs, who were critically injured. Now, that's insensitivity. And so it was, there are some really, really, great messaging debates that go on in our history. Hamilton versus Madison over federalism. This is not one of them.
What's getting lost in this, too, is the governor's got to demonstrate at some point that he can deliver Republican votes on a tough issue. He wasn't able to do it on the international bridge, but he managed to work around the legislature. He hasn't been able to do it so far on transportation funding. He's not been able to do it on Medicaid expansion, which we haven't talked about yet, but he hasn't. So far, nothing's positive is happening there from his point of view on his proposal. At some point, he's going to demonstrate he can produce Republican votes before the Democrats are going to walk the plank for him.
I wanted to get to Rick Pluta's point, though. I don't think the posturing is done yet, obviously, on this road funding debate. And the reason is there's still hard feelings from the right-to-work debate over lame duck. The Democrats got completely steamrolled in December. Everything the Republicans wanted, they got done without one Democratic vote. And the Democrats are still sore about
that.
You
can even circle back and say, some of the paranoia about Skunk Works was related to that, too.
Oh, absolutely. You can go back to 2011. All those things. The Democrats are just paranoid about dealing with Republicans because of the past history. So there's going to be this type of posturing before we can get actually something done.
Sure. One of the things we're hearing is that they want their agreements in writing.
Right?
Well, I talked with Gretchen Whitmer about this yesterday, and she was saying that the polling is showing that whether it's raising the sales tax, which requires 2/3 vote in the legislature and a constitutional amendment referendum, whatever it is, if there's not some tie-in with education as well, just a tax increase for transportation doesn't fly with the voters.
Should we expect passage of some kind of measure this session?
No.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. 2 yes, 1 no.
But I think the question is, will it be enough?
Yeah.
The governor wants $1.2 billion, and yeah, I am. That's what I do.
I think it will be in the
ballpark.
Well,
the need is about 1.6. The governor wants 1.2. We'll see if it hits that.
And it will be a law by committee, no doubt about that. This
right.
will be input from all over the place, right? We should all take the advice of an online commenter at the Detroit News Online. This person simply said, if you drive slower, the roads feel smooth. So we're driving good. Great advice. Medicaid expansion. Walt, you mentioned this a minute ago. This was a persistent topic all month. You're working on a piece on this. Review for us where we're at and tell us about your story.
Well, it's an interesting situation because, among other things, Medicaid expansion saves the state money in the long term. It's about $1.1 billion over the next decade because of the federal money that would be coming in. The feds would be taking over costs for mental health, for medical treatment for prisoners, those sorts of things. It would expand the number of people covered by insurance or Medicaid in Michigan by some say as many as 1 million people, about 450,000 of them expanded Medicaid coverage. Republicans aren't buying it at this point. The word Obama is toxic to an awful lot of the Republican caucus. They don't care what it is. It can be Obama kittens, and they're going to be against it. But it seems like where this is going is the polling is showing there's a lot more public support for it and perhaps more legislative support on the Republican side for it if the state can get a waiver and require people in Medicaid to have a copay, to have a greater copay or participate in the premium a little bit on the theory. It's part of this broader theory that poor people simply don't pay enough in taxes.
Well, what Republicans are looking for is something that will give them enough cover among their constituency to walk that plank on doing anything that smacks of supporting any aspect of Obamacare.
Right, because you can't have Medicaid expansion. It's got to be Medicaid reform. We got to reform the system so that the people who are receiving Medicaid go to the doctor every year, that they quit smoking, maybe they watch their weight.
And Kyle is using the nomenclature shift that they're trying to accomplish.
Yes,
not
exactly.
Expansion, but reform.
Exactly. I mean, because that's important, because you start talking about expanding government, there's a bad connotation with that in Tea Party groups, and they don't want to get on the wrong side of them.
Your nominations here for most overlooked, underreported story for the month of April. Anybody?
I think even though there's been some coverage of it, I think locally a big story is going to be we're going to have an incredibly dirty city council campaign. It's going to get very, very nasty, especially in the
fourth.
Canfora, a Yorko campaign in the fourth.
That's where Kyle and I live, and I would say it's already there.
Yeah, it's getting there, that's for sure. You know, I guess my nomination would be, and there's been some coverage of this, is the idea of taking away welfare benefits from people whose kids are skipping school, the truancy debate. Because that bill is going through the House right now, and I would expect that's going to get to the governor and get signed. And I think what's interesting is that the administration allegedly has been doing this for some time. I don't think it's gotten a lot of news coverage at all, but the idea that we're trying to keep kids in school and attaching the welfare hammer to it, I think it's pretty interesting.
I think the prospect of the new state budget jeopardizing the state's agreement with the regarding the children's rights lawsuit in foster care.
Okay. Anybody going to be watching the this proposal, apparently, to tax online purchases in Michigan?
Yeah, you know, I've been watching that for 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, haven't we been watching this forever, Rick? And I guess I've just become immune to it, that it's not really going to happen. It's just some kind of fantasy that's out.
It is happening.
I know it's happening, but it's hard to believe that it's going to happen.
It's happening incrementally. This is not going to be, you know, a ton of bricks that drops. It's just slowly over time, more and more retailers are going to come on board, and eventually paying taxes on retail purchases is going to be normal as paying them at the brick-and-mortar stores.
I was somewhat surprised. I guess my nominee for overlooked, underreported for the month would be the Notre Dame study. If you heard about this at all, there was a study that came out of Notre Dame. A guy from Central Michigan worked on the study as well, that said that the existence of Asian carp in the Great Lakes is likely. They're already here, according to DNA studies.
Actually, there's been some science that says that suggested that already. That in itself is not a bombshell. The question is, you know, that they assume that there are some scattered here and there, just not in large enough numbers to create the problems that we're afraid of if there's actually a real migration.
We have, yeah, but we've been led to believe these things are so predatory. If any of them are here, it's like, oh. Look out.
I know, it's a little bit like
four.
Asian carp is the new land shark.
We want to thank all of our guests here for looking back on the month of April and spending a fair amount of time looking ahead as well. That's always fun. Rick Plute of the Michigan Public Radio Network. Walt Sorg is a columnist for City Pulse. And Kyle Malin is back from MERS, the Michigan Information and Research Service. Many thanks, guys.
See you again soon.
Still to come on Current State, building sustainable local food systems in Michigan. We'll talk with MSU Professor of Sustainable Agriculture, Michael Hamm, and we'll explore East Lansing Modern. That's an architectural style. Susan Bandies joins us on the second half of Current State. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State. You're tuned to 90.5 WKAR, also on WKAR.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. This month, Strolling of the Heifers, a Vermont-based local food advocacy group, released their second annual Locavore Index. Now, this Locavore Index ranks states based on their commitment to local food. Michigan earned spot number 22 on that list. Mike Hamm is the C.S. Mott Professor of Sustainable Agriculture at Michigan State University and head of the C.S. Mott Group for Sustainable Food Systems, and he joins us to discuss the growth and the future of sustainable food systems in Michigan. Mike, good to see you.
Thank you very much.
Tell us what a local food system looks like, and just as importantly, why is that important?
So what a local food system looks like, what most people would think of is going to the farmer's market on Saturday morning or Wednesday night after work and buying some food from produce, especially from a local farmer. And 20 years ago, that was pretty much true. Today, a local food system is that, and in great abundance. We've got over 300 farmer's markets in Michigan today, where at the beginning of this century, we had about 85 or 90. It's also community-supported agriculture farms where people buy a share of what's produced at that farm at the beginning of the season. So in essence, they serve customer service, the bank for the farmer, so they have money up front. But today, it's also about going through wholesalers and distributors to have produce at Meijer's and at Spartan stores and various grocery stores and supermarkets. It's about our school lunch programs in the K through 12 school systems across the state of Michigan, purchasing from local farmers and serving fresh vegetables and fresh milk in the schools during lunch. It's about restaurants advertising on their menus that they're working with local farmers and regional farmers in Michigan to get produce and meat and eggs and dairy products and cheese that they can serve in their restaurants. So today, it's about an entire food system from the production of food to the distribution, processing, wholesaling, and retailing of that food, and getting it both in direct market outlets through farmers markets and CSAs and roadside stands, and getting it at restaurants and supermarkets and corner grocery stores and every place where we source food.
Well, you've made quite an economic case here for a local food system, but I gather there are environmental impacts to buying locally or regionally as well. Tell us about that.
So one of the things that we think is that there certainly is a lot of verbiage out there that in fact that this lowers the environmental footprint, the carbon footprint, whatever you want to call it, of food that we get, and that it's a big...
How so, though, exactly?
Well, one of the arguments is that since food isn't shipped long distances, that all that transportation cost and all the CO2 release associated with that is reduced in a local food system. And quite frankly, as an academic and as a scholar and as a researcher, what I have to say to that is it depends. So that could be true. We did some research recently on producing food indoors in the winter in high tunnels like we do at the Student Organic Farm here at MSU and many farmers in the state versus getting it from California. And there certainly is a reduced carbon footprint of getting that food, the lettuce greens, from inside those hoop houses in Michigan than getting it from California, depending on how consumers travel to get that food. So the way that we move about in our cars has a big impact on the environmental footprint of that food.
So it's not just the distribution of the commodity itself, it's how the consumer gets to it's for sale.
That's right. There's a lot of that. And then we can also talk about the economic impact. And we do have a number of modeling studies, and we've done some here in Michigan and others have done them in other places, that look at the fact that this is a big economic development opportunity for states across the country. There's another big piece of it too, which is that we tend to eat fairly poorly. We tend to consume, you and I and everybody else that's associated with the show, probably eats about half the fruits and vegetables they should on a daily basis. And what we've shown is that if we, in fact, increase our consumption of fruits and vegetables to achieve closer to public health standards, which would also potentially impact healthcare costs and all the other debates we're having about healthcare right now, that in fact we could build jobs, we could provide opportunities for residents in Michigan to be employed, to have decent jobs, and for us to be a healthier state. So there's a lot of things wrapped up in local food systems that we can tie together for Michigan.
Are local communities, municipalities, beginning to think in terms of their local food systems, or is this off their radar now, or is it just getting on, or how far advanced is this thinking?
This is becoming much more on people's radar in Michigan. We'll just talk about Michigan and not the country as a whole right now. So that report that you talked about ranked Michigan number 22. If you look at the crude data before they account for population density of the states, we actually ranked third in the country behind California and New York. I would argue, after looking at their study and how they did their analysis, that we're somewhere between 3 and 22. I think 22 were higher than that. I think 3 were lower than that when you take population into account. And that's because in the 21st century, in the last 13 years, Michigan has moved tremendously at increasing farmers' markets, at providing state money. Last year, there's $1 million of government, state government money that's gone into food hub creation, which are entities that look at how they can consolidate and distribute and market fresh food from small and medium-scale farmers across Michigan. And what we've seen in different regions of the state, in the Traverse City area, here in the Lansing area, in Detroit, in the Upper Peninsula, in the Marquette area, is the development of municipal and county and regional level government-created activities that look at how they can utilize local and regional food systems in their aid, in their regions, to build the economy, to improve public health, and to basically create a better standard of living for the population that they serve.
To the extent, Mike Hamm, that we already have a global food system network, is there resistance to the local food system idea?
Well, certainly in many cases there is. And the way that we look at it is if we go back to that public health notion that we need to eat a better diet, there's opportunity to maintain what we have right now on a national and global basis and expand what we have on a local and regional basis. The other side of that is that we make the assumptions that what's going on nationally and globally right now will continue into the future with no problem, and so there's no reason to do what we're doing now. However, right now domestically, half of our fresh produce is produced in California. California by 2050 will have 14 million more people. We'll have less fresh water because of both climate change and population growth. We'll have less land available for food production because of population growth and a number of other things. And so for them to be able to do that in the future is problematic. And so part of this is also thinking about the future and distributing the risk that we have in our food supply right now by having very concentrated points at which we get it from and ensuring, in fact, that we have a sustainable food supply when my 14-year-old daughter is 40 or 50 years old.
So there's a security dimension that enters into this.
I think one of the biggest arguments for this on a national basis is a national security argument.
About that. We are talking with Mike Hamm. He is C.S. Mott Professor of Sustainable Agriculture here at MSU about local food systems. Do you think consumers then, are consumers demonstrating a greater eagerness to buy local?
I think
an awful lot of emphasis on this. A lot of producers are promoting that.
Absolutely. And it is a market opportunity. And it is a market opportunity that seems to be growing at an increasing rate. So I'll give you an example. K through 12 school programs, which the school lunch program, all we've heard over the years is how bad the food is in school lunch, et cetera, with food service directors doing a yeoman's task with about 90 cents per meal to buy the food. Think about that, 90 cents to put that food on the plate for the kid in terms of the food costs. In 2004, soon after I got here, we did a survey of food service directors across the state, and about 10% of them said that they had purchase local agricultural products sometime in the last year. Fast forward to 2012, 40% are saying the same thing. So that's a tremendous growth in 8 years in our K through 12 school program, lunch programs, with very restricted budgets for food. If we look at restaurants, when I got here in 2003, and this is not because of me, but when I got here in 2003, I don't know of any outside of Villegas, which is no longer here. I don't know of any restaurants in the Lansing area that were sourcing local food. Now we have two slow food trucks, Trailer Parked and Purple Carrot. We have a variety of restaurants, some of which are really focused on local food sourcing,
Bend in
and
the
some
road,
of which
right?
do more.
Fork in the Road.
We've got Red Haven, and we've got a number of others that are doing smaller amounts. I know farmers in the area that all of their market now is almost entirely to the restaurant industry in the area. That's tremendous growth.
You alluded to the student organic farm a few minutes ago at Michigan State. This is such a neat thing. You're gearing up for a growing season over there.
They are.
And what is your connection to the student organic farm?
My connection is as the endowed chair chair in sustainable agriculture. I have some resources that I put into them every year and help them buy equipment and things. Otherwise, they go out there and do a great job. John Birnbaum is the faculty member in horticulture that really got that going with a group of students. Jerry Mukhtar is the manager out there and runs. They have a 10-month organic farm training program where they train 15 people a year in four-season production. And how to grow things all year in both an academic and an experiential sense. It's a great program.
Mike Hamm is the C.S. Mott Professor of Sustainable Agriculture at MSU and head of the C.S. Mott Group for Sustainable Food Systems. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Thank you so much.
This environmental segment of Current State is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. And for more news on the Great Lakes environment, you can check out greatlakesecho.org. MSU Art and Art History Professor Susan Bandies has run a student project this year examining notable architecture in East Lansing. The focus has been on homes and businesses built between 1940 and 1970. There's a book about the project in the works. That era saw some remarkable buildings go up in East Lansing. In several cases, preservation could become an issue. They aren't old enough to be listed on historic registries. The MSU Museum has opened an exhibit related to the project. It's called East Lansing Modern. WKAR's Scott Pohl met Susan Bandies at the museum to have a look. They noted that among the flat roofs favored at the time, two buildings stand out for their curves and zigzags, the Bell's Pizza location and the Bigby Coffee, both on Grand River Avenue.
You're referring to what's called Googie architecture, which comes out of California and the automobile culture. So businesses wanted people to see a building from the street as they were driving by. So you start seeing buildings that have a sense of humor or really make a statement, kind of exaggerate what they are. So that is happening at the same time as the much more staid kind of modernist architecture. But it's a 50s phenomenon, 50s and 60s, and because we have two good examples, I wanted to include them.
I wanted to talk with you further about the Bigby Coffee because it's facing the possibility of demolition as part of an effort to reconstitute that part of East Lansing. Does that make you a little sad that that building might go?
It does, and originally I was not including it in the show, and then I thought maybe this will be a way to call attention to that building and its history. And I hope the whole exhibit does that. I mean, people still don't pay too much attention to modernist architecture. And the State Historic Preservation Office's project to inventory this kind of architecture is so that we pay attention. You know, the buildings are not old enough to be on the historic register. So they do fall in this sort of no man's land of lack of protection. So a show like this hopefully makes people look around a little bit more and appreciate what we have.
Before it was a coffee shop, it was an Arby's restaurant. Were there other uses for the building besides those two, to your knowledge?
Not that I know of, but it looks the way it does because it was an Arby's. It's supposed to be a Conestoga wagon. And the logo for Arby's, the original one, was a 10-gallon hat. So it fits. When you know that, the building makes so much sense.
One thing that excites me about having an exhibit like this at the museum is that people who haven't heard about the project will not only hear about it, but see photographs of the building. And I imagine in a lot of cases, oh, I've been in that building. I've seen that home. I had no idea that there was some historical significance possibly attached to that building. That sort of interest could grow from having an exhibit like this here.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that people will come forward with more information. There are still buildings that I know were architect designed, but I don't know who the architect is. They look like styles that I'm beginning to distinguish. So there's much more to discover.
I wonder if some of the architecture firms still exist, perhaps still have records from this era that will lead you to some of that detective work you're talking about?
No, unfortunately, the large firms from the 50s and 60s merged with other firms, and now there's one large firm, Myote Group, that kind of took the others in. But Warren Holmes doesn't exist anymore, and Kenneth Black. So it's been a real detective story trying to find the information. And some of the buildings have their own archives. Like Eastminster has a lot of information about their Dow connection, Alden Dow connection. But some of the others don't. You know, they have changed over time, and somehow the documents are missing. I'm still discovering architects for whom there's very little in terms of documents and resources. Still sort of discovering things about particular buildings that I didn't know the total story of. So I see this as a work in progress.
So one academic class wasn't enough to get the job done. Is it something you think you might pursue with future classes then to continue the work?
Well, this semester I had two research assistants, and they did a lot of the grunt work, like reading the Lansing State Journal for every day in 1950 and 51, because there was a writer who wrote on Sundays about architecture and about particular buildings that were being built. Plus, we've gotten a lot of interesting statistics about how many houses were built in a particular quarter of the year. So there's more of that research to do. I will continue working on this through the summer and have a deadline of January for the book.
Tell me what you think your students got out of being involved in this project and what maybe they have said they got out of it, because I don't think of detective work like this as being part of the art world necessarily for a student. How did this play out for your students?
Well, I think I can answer that in several ways. One, there isn't very much taught in terms of architecture in at least our program. So on a very basic level, I think it made students much more aware of the built environment, and they started looking at buildings in a very different way and understanding how spaces work. I think historically they got a perspective on the growth of the city, and in terms of research skills, because you can't Google and find anything. So it was really detective work and how you do original research, which is not always easy. And sometimes it's a matter of knowing the right question to ask. And so it was, I think, one of the best research experiences that a student could have had.
All right, now the exhibit includes some artifacts from that era in a different room. We're gonna perhaps walk over there, I hope, and you can explain to me why they're included in the exhibit and give us some more background about some of these items. We have four display cases, and are these chairs part of the exhibit,
yes,
or did someone just bring them out here?
No, they are for people to sit in.
Okay, well, explain why they're here then.
The students in my course in the fall had a chance to sit in Mies van der Rohe designed Barcelona chairs at the Michigan State Medical Society. And when I was talking about the exhibition, a lot of them said how important that was and how wonderful it was to actually sit in them. And I realized that we actually had these two chairs that were used to be in one of the administration buildings maybe 15 years ago. They're not in the best condition, so they were never accessioned into the art museum collection, but they weren't given away. So this gave us an opportunity to bring them out and actually have people sit in them and see what's so wonderful about modern design.
So with four display cases here, we have some artifacts from this era, 1940 to 1970. Can you explain your thinking behind why some of these pieces were included?
What I was trying to tell a rather local story as well as a more global story. So one of the cases is full of Russell Wright dishes. And Betty Price, who was a local businesswoman, had a store in downtown Lansing, Lieberman's. It was the place you went to learn about modernist design. She sold a ton of Russell Wright. So actually the pieces that we have included came from a local collection. So I was trying to give a sense of what people in this area would have put in their homes and also how they learned about modernist design. So another case has books, and they're sort of how-to books. There's also catalogs from two World's Fairs, because millions of people went to the World's Fair in Chicago in 1933 and the New York one in 1964 and learned about the future and model homes and new appliances. There's also early catalogs from Herman Miller, the Zeeland, Michigan company that produced a lot of the very contemporary furniture. And another case has artists who were very popular and well-known in mid-Michigan, Louis Rainer and Alma Getch and Catherine Winkler. So we have a few examples of their works, and that also allowed me the opportunity to talk about the Getch-Winkler House by Frank Lloyd Wright, which is an Okemos, so technically not part of an East Lansing show, but so many people knew Getch and Winkler and also visited the house, and it did have an influence on the way people in East Lansing thought about contemporary architecture. The fourth case has examples of new technology. And there I am hoping that people of a certain age will go, oh yeah, I remember that, the princess phone and the paper dress. And students will go, what is that? You know? the same thing with the fallout shelter sign that we borrowed, which, you know, when I was growing up, those were all over, but you don't see them now. So again, younger people will have no idea what it meant and how ubiquitous a sign like that was. So I was trying to give a flavor of what a house might be filled with through these cases and how we learned about modernism in the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
I had wondered if some of the people who still live in some of these homes might have loaned you things that survived from that era.
Some of the pieces were actually donated by people who lived in modernist homes, and other pieces I've just been asking around, and lots of people had leftover bits of Miramico that I was able to borrow, and others are specific collectors of 50s objects.
What can you tell me about how long this will be on display at the MSU Museum?
This is on display through August 19th, so through the summer. We have a driving and biking tour that I will have some copies in print, but it's also downloadable from the MichiganModern.org website that I collaborated with the State Historic Preservation Office to produce. So that leads you through 16 buildings in East Lansing, both buildings that are open to the public and then just sort of passing through because they're residences. We hope people will take the time to actually look at the modernist architecture in town.
Well, Susan Bandes, after talking with you about this project in its infancy, it's interesting to see how it has played out and to know that there's more work to be done and more to learn about and enjoy in the future.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl at the MSU Museum.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Susan. Coming up on Current State tomorrow, we'll discuss the Michigan Grand River Avenue Vision Charrette. Also, we speak with Michael Finney, President and CEO of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. That and more Wednesday here on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Gabrielle Saldivia and Sonia Treweiler for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.